This is Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, what is AppHarvest?
AppHarvest is taking proven technologies that we have seen in the Netherlands, a country that is one-third the size of Kentucky in landmass, could fit the entire country, the Netherlands, in eastern Kentucky. And we're taking those proven technologies and deploying them in our region.
Jonathan Webb lays out his vision for a high-tech 60-acre greenhouse operation near Moorhead. And is all of the divisiveness happening around you these days growing old?
I think a lot of people would love to do something about the divisiveness they feel with folks on the other side of the aisle or in a different community, but they just don't know where to start.
Savannah Barrett here to tell us about one place to start, the Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange. First, Sky Marietta is with us in the studio here at Eastern Standard. Welcome, Sky.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I want to talk to you about your ideas for the development of a creative economy in Appalachian Kentucky, because I know that's very near and dear to your heart. You've practiced it. And first, though, a little background about you for context for folks who don't know about that. And as a time saver, so that we can get into the meat of the interview, I've bullet-pointed your resume. You tell me if I'm correct about all this.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, you grew up in Berea.
Yes.
One of 7 kids.
That's right.
Got your undergrad degree in psychology from Yale.
Mm-hmm.
You joined Teach for America, and that took you to a teaching job with the Navajo Nation in New Mexico.
Yes.
And that's where you met Jeff Marietta.
That's right.
Then on to Harvard graduate, where you studied childhood development and language and literacy development and earned a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And then I understand that an illness in your family brought you all back to Berea, back to Kentucky. And Jeff became the executive director at Pine Mountain Settlement School. And you started the Little School at Pine Mountain. Now, I know that you and Jeff have since moved on to other things and are no longer at Pine Mountain, but let's begin there if we can. And if you could talk to us a little bit about the concept behind the Little School.
Sure. Well, and I will say there is no fully moving on from Pine Mountain Settlement School. My mom was a teacher there. We got married there. We're just very deeply embedded at Pine Mountain. But Pine Mountain is one of these settlement schools that was founded in the mountains of Appalachia to help local people bring about their own jobs and economy really back in the 20s, right? So early on, there was this vision of helping the community build on their crafts, build on their traditional folkways, and really create lives that they wanted. At Pine Mountain Settlement School, it had started then as, you know, a high school that would take children from around the mountains who perhaps had too far to travel, and then had continued as a community school and had pivoted to become an environmental education facility in the 70s. It was a pioneering place, or Pine Mountain was a pioneering place for early childhood education. There is a wonderful woman there named Millie Mahoney who started an early childhood program before there were things like Head Start. And in fact, it was visited for the Head Start program. And then what I came along and did was relaunched it. It had closed in the 90s. It had petered out then. And we reinvented it for the needs of the community at the time. So it's less a daycare facility and more a gathering place for multiple generations. It meets 3 days a week. There's a healthy lunch served to the children. It's very place-based, experiential, exploratory, but it also includes whoever are their caregivers. So one of the big aims of it is to reduce social isolation. And to really bring people together for, you know, wonderful place-based experiences. And it's continuing on right now with Tara Slesher is the current teacher, and she was actually recently recognized as one of 17 national early learning champions through PBS.
It sounds to me like what you're doing now is a logical extension of all that background that you just described for me, because you're literally an arts extension associate with CEDIC, which is Community and Economic Development of Kentucky, based at UK, I believe.
That's correct.
And that brings us to your vision of developing a creative economy in eastern Kentucky. And in a moment, I want to talk about a very concrete way that you're carrying out that mission in downtown Corbin and Harlan. We'll get into that in a moment. But if you could first give us an overview, what would a creative economy look like in eastern Kentucky?
Right. Well, a creative economy, we often think about in terms of two big buckets, which is livable. How vibrant of a community are you in? How willing would you be to stay because of events that are happening and opportunities to shop and do interesting things? We also talk a lot about tourism and how do we bring people to the community. In Eastern Kentucky specifically, we have this tremendous world-class resource, which is our natural beauty and our natural assets. So to me, my vision for a creative economy in Eastern Kentucky would be the sorts of music and retail and arts experiences, but they would be anchored in what really draws people to Eastern Kentucky. It's worth driving 4 hours, frankly, to come and take some of the hikes and see some of the vistas that are around the region. And we really wanted people to take a regional approach, to think about an itinerary where they can go from town to town and really experience the natural beauty, but also the very unique cultural assets that we have in these communities.
The town aspect is really important to that. When we're asking people to come in from other places, there have to be accommodations, there have to be restaurants, that kind of thing. And I mentioned that in addition to talking the talk, you very much walk the walk in that regard. It came to our attention with the recent TEDx event in Corbin, which happened at a place called Second and Main. Tell us about that.
All right. Well, Second and Main is an event space. It's in a 1920s historic downtown JCPenney building that my husband and I purchased, I guess, a year and a half or maybe 2 years ago. It had been vacant in Main Street, Corbin, for about a decade. And we bought it. It had no electric, plumbing, or HVAC in it. So those pieces were put in. It's now a multi-purpose building. It has Second and Main, which is the event space. It has co-working space. It has retail space in it, which is a store named Moombo, which specializes in local arts and crafts of the region. And then on the third floor, it has a couple of apartments. And that's, in fact, where we live now.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know that you've also purchased a property in Harlan. Same concept?
Well, there's a long and funny story behind the property in Harlan, also on Main Street, called the Buttermore Building, where basically the Buttermore family realized they could no longer take care of it. And my husband, Jeff, had reached out to them, and they ended up selling him the building for a dollar, which I think is a really remarkable story of how families that have owned some of these historic buildings for many generations or for a long time can think about how can we best fulfill the purpose of that building. It was Harlan's first hotel. It's a little bit older than Second and Main. I think it was built in the 1890s.
What are you going to do with it?
Well, plans for it right now are to also turn it into event space that can be used in Harlan. And then my husband, Jeff, is president of the Harlan County Chamber of Commerce, and I know he really wants Harlan to have a coffee shop in it. I think I'm on board for that vision, but there's a few steps between here and then.
You know, listening to you, Sky, and other people that we have on Eastern Standard talking about what's going on in Eastern Kentucky, it's really very uplifting and exciting. And I want to know if you agree with me. I'm getting this sense. Do you sense that people in our region, many who have been working for years on this, are now reaching some kind of a new level of communication and collaboration on ways to more or less bring about the rebirth of Eastern Kentucky?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously it's been a time of tremendous economic transition for the region, and that's really difficult. But at the same time, with that comes tremendous opportunity. And, you know, you can do things like buy a downtown building. There are a lot of micro businesses that are springing up. I say a lot that the women of the region are the ones who are redoing our main streets, are the ones putting in the coffee shops and the restaurants and the great retail spaces. And I think generally you see people working together and it really creating momentum. When you take a town like Pineville, it's completely transformed from where it was even 3 years ago.
One of the things that I think we all grind our gears over and expend an awful lot of angst and energy over is how we're perceived by the outside world. You spent a lot of years away from Kentucky. I did. Many of us have done that. But also we've returned and have brought with us an understanding of how people outside of our region see us, how they perceive us and it. Did that experience for you, I know at least a decade in Boston, time in New Mexico, did that play a role in your ideas about what needs to happen to overcome the stereotypes and the assumptions that have been made about us and become such a burden?
I think it definitely has played into it. I would say that in general, I feel like the attitudes in places like Boston and New York are actually in many ways friendlier than they sometimes are in central Kentucky. People are very fascinated with the Appalachian region. And then what's interesting is in New Mexico, I lived on the Navajo Nation, and that's a community that has really been able to embrace their cultural heritage, that has a lot of pride in it. So to me, I look at New Mexico as a real example of what we might be able to achieve in Eastern Kentucky. And whereas I think we all sort of in Kentucky can know that people would be interested in, say, the Navajo Nation and Navajo culture, I find that in places like Boston and New York, sure, there's stereotypes, and especially with the last presidential election. But in general, people are very interested in this region. And we've had people visit from all over the world and have a tremendous time.
You know, you've touched on something I think is really important, that various perceptions exist within the Commonwealth that mm-hmm. are more difficult in Boston, New York, LA, wherever. Being from Kentucky can mean something interesting. It can also mean that you're a hillbilly in the best sense right. of the term. Whereas in Kentucky, being from Lexington, Pikeville, Louisville, Corbin, Paducah, or Hazard, or wherever, all mean very different things to different people. Kind of confusing. Your thoughts?
Well, as you know, Pine Mountain Settlement School, as just one example, has had more and more people come and visit it. And it's really interesting because a lot of those visitors come from Louisville, you know, and people coming from Louisville to Harlan County, that's one of the longer trips you could take. And I found it was often harder to get people from central Kentucky to come. And, you know, you hear people talk about things like, oh, Eastern Kentucky is the redheaded stepchild of Kentucky or whatever. I think we do need to realize as a state that we are only as strong as we are in each of our pieces. And Eastern Kentucky is, again, has tremendous assets that people from all over the world can come in and visit and enjoy the mountains, the rivers, you know, the unique cultural heritage of the place. And I really urge people who are more centrally located to take the time and come and visit us. That's really how we're going to bring about a just economic transformation. And the great thing is in this day of social media, even some of your listeners now, if they came and took the trip, have this chance to have rippling impacts on who's willing to come and how they're willing to spend their money.
So what is next on Sky Marietta's agenda?
One of the things that I'm very focused on right now, again, are these sort of micro businesses and supporting the small businesses that really help make a trip to the region really interesting. Again, it comes back to restaurants, Airbnb, great places to stay, supporting them, particularly supporting the women-led businesses of Eastern Kentucky. We put on a conference last year called Mountain Women Mean Business. We're trying to grow that and continue that. But I also really just want to get the word out. So I just want somebody to know, well, hey, if I'm interested in coming to Eastern Kentucky, here's a great trip that I can take. Here's some great hikes I can go on. Here are the places to eat. Because I would say that structure is in place and people often just don't know about it. And particularly in the spring, there's a lot of wonderful festivals. Festivals are a great time to come down, get lots of opportunities to, you know, meet interesting local artists and vendors, and really just trying to help people understand what are their entry points to the region and bring them down. Because I find that once somebody comes down to visit, they're very likely to come back and maybe bring some friends.
Let's say somebody like that is listening and they're wondering, well, who do I get in touch with? How do they make that contact?
Well, one place they could go is I do run a Facebook page called Eastern Kentucky Arts Network, and it posts about various concerts, festivals. We put out posters. They're certainly free to contact me directly. I'm always happy to talk with people about what are their, you know, opportunities in Eastern Kentucky for a visit.
Sky Marietta is an Arts Extension Associate with Community and Economic Development of Kentucky and owner of the performance and event space Second and Main in Corbin. Thank you so much, Sky.
Well, thank you.
Coming up after the break,
how do we harness that passion that's fighting for sustainable development, and how do we try to get some of that working with us?
Questions on Jonathan Webb's mind as he works to bring a large-scale $80 million high-tech greenhouse operation to Eastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com. Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
Jonathan Webb joins us now. Jonathan's a Kentucky native and a University of Kentucky graduate with a dream of a high-tech farming hub in Appalachia. His company is called App Harvest. You may have seen a report about it on 60 Minutes in mid-March. Jonathan's plan is to build enormous greenhouses where the company would combine conventional agricultural techniques with technologies to grow produce that would be sold to supermarket chains. We thank you for joining us, Jonathan.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So to begin with, if you were pressed to do an elevator pitch about what is App Harvest, what would you say?
Tom, App Harvest is taking proven technologies that we have seen in the Netherlands, a country that is one-third the size of Kentucky in landmass, could fit the entire country of the Netherlands in eastern Kentucky. And we're taking those proven technologies and deploying them in our region. The Netherlands has the second most agriculture exports in the world, only behind the United States, and that is because they grow with massive efficiency with very little input. So 80 to 90% less water than open field agriculture, no harsh chemical pesticides. And because of our wonderful geographic location, we were able to get to 70% of the U.S. population in a one-day drive. So we are looking to replace those imports that are coming from foreign countries. Specifically, produce imports from Mexico have nearly tripled over the last 10 to 15 years, 4 billion pounds of tomatoes last year alone. So we want to take that production that's currently sitting 5 days on an 18-wheeler to get to major markets on the eastern seaboard. And we want to reduce that down to a one-day truck drive, which would ultimately reduce our environmental impact and footprint from the diesel of the transport.
Now that you've given us an idea of what you envision, let's talk about how you got there. You spent a lot of time working in D.C. in the Defense Department. What did you do there, and how did that inform what you've come up with?
So previously to App Harvest, I was in D.C., spent about 10 years in the renewable space, about six, seven, eight, and then got into what was a position that was to represent a White House initiative under the last administration. The Department of Defense is one of the largest electricity consumers in the U.S. They thought if you could get them to purchase 20% of their power from renewables by 2025, you're really shifting the market. So we had to privately finance those projects. And I was a part of building what at the time was the largest solar projects in the southeast of the U.S. It was 750 acres of solar down at Fort Benning, Fort Stewart, and Fort Gordon, about 250 acres apiece and combined 750 acres. So I was in this world evaluating technologies on the energy side and got really plugged into the sustainable community. And I'm someone who's like anybody who grows up playing in a creek or walking outside, I'm deeply committed to the environment. And at this point in my life, you know, I didn't buy a car until I came back to Kentucky. I'd used public transportation in D.C. and in New York. I eat mainly plants. I try to be conscious about what my impact is. But the divide that I saw in D.C. and in New York from what I consider to be some of the brightest and most brilliant minds, an extremely well-funded network of people working in the sustainable community. At one point, solar was nearly the number one job creator in the U.S. because of the construction jobs. And everybody around the world, frankly, around the globe, saw the wild positive benefits of what we would call sustainable development. And yet the eastern part of our state got walloped in the decline of coal. So it doesn't matter if you where your position is environmentally. I've tried to communicate that, you know, it has not been an effort against the coal. That's a piece of rock in the ground, right? It's communities that have been deeply impacted. And these are communities that have frankly already been challenged anyways. That the one industry that we had in the eastern part of our state was really ripped out from underneath of us. And it was done by a community that was wildly funded and brilliant in so many ways. So how do we harness that passion that's on that's fighting for sustainable development, and how do we try to get some of that working with us? So the thesis around App Harvest was really what can we develop at scale? And so a huge fan of energy development and enjoyed my work in the solar world. But what we saw in the agriculture industry in the Netherlands is what I've equated and what many of us think is wind and solar 10 to 15 years ago, where I think in the U.S. we're going to see a massive amount of build out where we're going to bring production indoors. So what happened was, and this happened with the solar world. So the price of the technology was dropping while the efficiency was going up. And so they were able to compete with conventional. So we could build a project that cost us less. It was dropping rapidly. At one point, I think solar was dropping. Prices were dropping half in a year. So just the prices were plummeting to be able to build while we were getting more electrons out. Similarly, in controlled environment ag, if you look at what's happened in the Netherlands, and there's been a couple of articles since we started this, not about AppHarvest, but about the Netherlands, and there's a National Geographic article. It says, "This tiny country feeds the world." I really encourage your listeners to look that one up. I'm a huge fan of clean tech. I think the issues we've seen is it's deploying those technologies at scale and just executing. So, you know, we can sit in laboratories or people can sit in San Francisco coming up with more ideas. But the reality is the country of the Netherlands has figured it out. And the rest of the world needs to catch up to where they are. And in essence, we're taking what's already proven at scale in Holland and bringing that over to our region.
So this revolves around a greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Very big one.
Big one.
And is that a part of the technology that the Netherlands has been so successful with?
So I try to say a greenhouse is not a greenhouse is not a greenhouse. And I kind of we frame this now as controlled environment agriculture, which is, you know, you've got everything from a, you know, kind of a plastic hoop house with maybe a dirt floor all the way up to kind of what we're doing, which is there's just totally different spectrums of what you would quote unquote call a greenhouse. What makes this what it is? Well, it's a steel and glass structure. So there's a couple ag tech companies in the U.S. that have gotten a lot of attention, Plenty and Bowery are two. So Plenty, I think they raised $200 million. Jeff Bezos led the round. Bowery recently raised $80 or $90 million through Google Ventures. So they're indoors. They're growing in warehouses and they're doing vertical farming. I'm a huge fan of urban and hyper-local and getting it as close as you can. I think that the difference between what they're doing, which is growing in a warehouse completely indoors versus what we're doing, with the glass greenhouses, what we're able to do is still utilize the two inputs that our wonderful planet gives us, which is sunlight and rainwater. So our facilities will run completely on recycled rainwater, which takes, as we all see, kind of this press on infrastructure with aging infrastructure and water issues. But then it's the technology inside the greenhouse. So the lighting that we supplement, so year-round we'll be able to grow. And in essence, what I've tried to say is the greenhouse itself is just living. So if a weather pattern's coming in, we have software, we have sensors, humidity controls. We're trying to control the environment inside the facility in order to maximize the climate for the specific plant varieties we're growing. It is to the plant itself simply altering nature, but we are in essence trying to align ourselves with what the best growing conditions are in nature and simply make that a controlled environment year round. But what that allows us to do is not use some of the other techniques that we see for open field agriculture. So the way in frankly, south of this border, they're using chemical pesticides that, frankly, the EPA can't track and in many cases are illegal pesticides that we can't even use in this country. We won't need to do that because we won't have the rampant pest that you might see in an open field environment. We will be introducing bees. So our pollination will be done through live bees. But yeah, this is, you know, as I've talked to lawmakers, even in D.C., you would think it's almost like SpaceX sending a rocket to the Mars. And I go, please, will you just go to the Netherlands and actually look at these facilities? They exist at scale. And we're not doing anything that's not already proven. And then our geographic location is really the biggest piece of this, which is we think the eastern part of our state was known for powering the country. It's well positioned to get to major markets. And we can hit 70% of the U.S. population from where we're at in the eastern part of our state.
Your website says these would be some of the largest greenhouses in the world. How big?
We had initial plans in Pikeville, and I will be with the University of Pikeville president next week and still committed to working in that community on more of a research effort with the university. But our first large production facility, we have moved over to Moorhead, and that first facility will be 60 acres under glass.
Have you acquired that land yet?
We have a lot of details that we plan on announcing here fairly soon that will certainly get you information regarding the site and the specifics of the project.
Do you plan to engage MSU, Morehead State University, and Rowan County students?
Absolutely. So we started our efforts in Pikeville, and I frankly, can't speak highly enough of that community and that leadership in that community who have well positioned Pikeville for being a leader in the eastern part of our state. But Morehead has been also equally accommodating, and I did meet with the Morehead State Uni president twice. We again have committed to working with the University of Pikeville, but frankly, we think there's an opportunity for all of the large institutions in our state. And I was with the ambassador of the Netherlands last week at their embassy, and we're working hard to try and get the major universities in the Netherlands linked up with our universities. I don't think that's AppHarvest's job per se to kind of run that effort, but we're doing our best to coordinate with the major universities in our state, from the University of Kentucky over to the University of Pikeville, and try to back channel with some of the major universities in the Netherlands.
These greenhouses, especially as high tech as they are, they have to be pretty costly. Mm-hmm. What sort of investment are we talking about?
Again, we should be announcing quite a few details here in the next couple of weeks, but the facility in Morehead is coming in roughly $80 million.
The Rise of the Rest Seed Fund hasn't released the exact amount they've given to AppHarvest, but their website says their typical investment ranges between $100,000 to $1 million. And while I'm sure that helps, is it enough?
Rise of the Rest and Steve Case and his team have been critically helpful in setting AppHarvest up for success. They are one investor of many other investors who, again, we're very excited to get some details out fairly soon of some other people that have recently invested. So Steve's whole purpose of that fund, Rise of the Rest, is to be catalytic capital. They want to get out front. They want to be the first ones to evaluate an opportunity. And I think in our case, it was really as a testament to what they're doing and why it's working. They were an early investor. We do have other investors that have followed on, but I think their conviction in getting out front and being willing to look at opportunities in the middle part of our country, that catalytic early stage capital was critical in capturing confidence in order to pull together the other folks required to move our efforts along.
There's something of an elephant in the room. One of your investors is controversial in Appalachian Kentucky, and I'm talking about J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy. There's been some pushback to his portrayal of Eastern Kentucky, concerns that his book has just continued the stereotyping of Appalachian people and culture. On the other hand, others argue that J.D. Vance has a right to his own interpretation of the social environment that shaped his life and his experience. And I don't want to make this about his book, but is that controversy in the region about an important investor in AppHarvest any kind of a problem for you?
Well, Tom, J.D. has been fighting like heck out in San Francisco and New York and D.C. to try to attract capital back to the region. And I definitely appreciate the work of Rise of the Rest. And he was an early champion standing beside me on trying to help me in any way he could. As far as the book goes, I'm not a historian or going to claim to be the smartest person in the room on the region. I see it as J.D. had his story of his life. But frankly, Tom, as I've been back in Kentucky over the past year, there's incredible artists and poets and activists and all kinds of people doing incredible work across this region, and their voices need to be heard. And I think that's the most important piece of this is how can we work together to try to elevate the conversation and ensure that people doing incredible work all across the region, that their work is highlighted. But I think this is a long road. It's not anything we're going to figure out in 2-3 years. Lord willing, I'll be on this planet another 30, 40 years. And I think it's going to take a long time to figure all this out. It's hard work. And there's a lot of people that are doing really, really good work. And I think we've got to find a way to highlight some of these incredible efforts that are taking place. So that's what I'm trying to focus on. In AppHarvest, we're surely not a silver bullet. We're a small player and a big picture of a region that has a lot of complexity. And I've just enjoyed getting to know people and hearing their stories. And over time, I hope we can use our platform to try to figure out how we navigate what we are doing to be a more helpful player in the bigger picture.
One of those people that's very much a very big part of this is Ramel Bradley. Tell us about his role.
Well, for those of you all that don't know Ramel Bradley, so we went to school together, and he was the captain of the winningest basketball program in college basketball history, and that's at the University of Kentucky, and he was a starting point guard. But I got to know Ramel when I moved to New York better. I went to church with his grandmother that ran his church in Brooklyn. I do not know a better person to be working on this with. And when I first started this, Ramel had been playing professional basketball overseas. And I said, Ramel, I know you never really thought what you'd do with that College of Agriculture degree, but I think we got an opportunity here. And he's dug in hard. So Ramel was in Pikeville earlier today. He's leading the efforts at Shelby Valley High School. Again, this is not easy work. It's hard work. But to see what he's doing there and to see the excitement in the kids. And frankly, Tom, that's what's been so encouraging. Anytime we feel like, oh, gosh, we got a setback or things are getting a little challenging. I think, and I could be wrong, but I think we had about 80 students apply to that program to get in with Ramel. I think 30 got in. So I met with Kimball Musk, who has square roots in Brooklyn, Elon's brother, and he's got these container units. And the thought was, well, I don't know that we can feed a huge segment of the population off container units, but what we can do is take this and put it at a high school, and let's see how it works. There's 30 students. I think the average ACT score is roughly a 27 of these 30 students. There's a young lady, Olivia Thornsberry, who is just an unbelievable. So when we say who are going to be these leaders in Central Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky, it's these students. And so our purpose of the container farm was, one, people will be able to walk out of there and have a bunch of skills that transcend up to anywhere. And maybe they'll come work with us, or maybe they'll go do their own thing. But it's been encouraging to see how do we shape this conversation and reimagine what's possible. And I think engaging with those next generation of leaders to see what are their ideas. But it's not going to be steel and glass and a couple facilities that define App Harvest. In order for us to be here for a couple of decades, we need young leadership that wants to reshape and reimagine what's possible.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask you, your website says that you hope to make the eastern part of Kentucky the ag tech capital of America. And of course, the region has heard many, many promises in the past. Do you believe this can actually be realized?
Tom, when I first got into this, there were some announcements that went out, and I think, you know, we definitely got ahead of ourselves on making announcements, but it's been a hard road the last 18 months. I am more confident today than ever before. The folks that have come to the table, the conversation that is taking place, it's not going to be me. It's not going to be Ramel. It's not going to be steel and glass that define what's happening. The fact that we're finding out that community colleges are already shaping ag tech or hydroponic programs, it's not any one institution. I think collectively we have an opportunity to make the eastern part. There is no one in the country that's leading on ag tech. And I've said, I don't think the future of farming is going to be in Brooklyn, New York, as much as Ramel, you're in the other room. I love Brooklyn, Ramel. I don't think the future of farming is going to be in Brooklyn. I don't think it's going to be in San Francisco. I think it's going to be somewhere in the middle part of our country. And I think Eastern Kentucky, absolutely, if we work together, we have the opportunity to lead at this, but it's going to take more than just App Harvest. But we're trying to do our best to lead the charge and make an impact in our own little way.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to follow your progress, and I hope you'll keep us posted as you go along and come back. Tell us how it's progressing.
Tom, absolutely. Appreciate the program. Program's important. Thank you for highlighting stories in Eastern Kentucky.
You bet. Jonathan Webb, founder of App Harvest, we thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Coming up after the break, the Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange is chiseling away at the barriers to progress in many communities across the state. We'll be joined by Savannah Barrett, founder of this partnership between Art of the Rural and Apple Shop. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the AllTech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Wish we could turn back time to the good old days when the mama sang us to sleep, but now we're stressed out.
Feeling stressed out? You are not alone. Here's WEKU's Stu Johnson.
The most recent national rankings by the personal finance website WalletHub place Kentucky as the fourth most stressed state in America. WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez says the report focuses on 40 indicators of stress. Gonzalez says Kentucky ranked low in the number of hours of sleep nightly and high in the percentage of citizens in fair or poor condition.
A lot of that goes back to things like obesity, eating habits, that then leads to things like heart disease, high cholesterol, diabetes, that then leads to medical emergencies, which are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy in the state.
Gonzalez says just understanding the underlying issues can help reduce stress. Only Mississippi ranked lower in the percentage of adults in fair to poor health. The WalletHub findings put West Virginia in the third spot in the health category. For WEKU, I'm Stu Johnson.
A particular source of stress these days is the grinding of gears, the getting wrapped around the axle over politics or ideology or perceptions of others, real or imagined. That we have our divisions, our barriers, is not new. Depictions of the ways Americans have gravitated into tribal camps are daily fare. What we hear much less of these days are stories about active attempts to overcome and even dissolve those boundaries, to remind us of the important things that we have in common. We're talking with Savannah Barrett, who, along with Josh May, is co-founder of the Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange, RUX. It's one of those efforts in these divisive times to find common ground among people. Savannah joins us from her office in Louisville to tell us how it all works. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be with you today.
The Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange, or RUX, as we call it, is the project of a partnership. Is that correct? Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, yes. It's a project of a partnership between Art of the Rural and Apple Shop, and is led by an amazing group of folks from all over the state, the Rural Urban Exchange Steering Committee. Art of the Rural is a national organization working to advance rural culture and serve rural folks. And Apple Shop is based in the coalfields in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and is a 50-year-old media-making organization.
As I said in the introduction, Savannah, divisions are all around us, social, political, religious, urban versus rural. We don't need to burn up a lot of time identifying all the sources of mutual disdain that are out there. But what would be useful, I think, is to hear about the currency of connection, the approach that you're taking to help people overcome differences and barriers, whether real or perceived.
You know, the currency of connection is based on the belief that while there's a diversity of opinions around us, we find that the divides that we perceive aren't as concrete as we've been led to believe. Particularly the rural-urban divide we see is more of a continuum. You know, most folks in Kentucky that live in cities aren't more than a couple generations removed from a rural heritage. And even if they don't have that rural background, in a state like Kentucky, rural and urban areas are vitally interdependent and they experience a shared future. So what we have found is, particularly when we focus on sense of place and when we focus on the values that we share across different communities and regions, we find common ground that can help us move forward.
For a long, long time, we've experienced an urban-rural divide in Kentucky, and it's often highlighted when our General Assembly convenes to determine statewide public policy and law. In a real practical sense, what happens at these community intensives that you hold to help people get beyond these entrenched biases and find that common ground? What goes on?
I think there are a couple of things about the community intensives that are really key to bringing folks into relationship with each other. Part of it is that we focus on people, place, and partnership. And the place component is just so important in a state like Kentucky. We bring rural and urban people together in unique community settings to activate them and to inspire them. It's pretty simple. We partner with a host in the community. This year, it's the Merle Travis Center in Powderly, Kentucky, the Appalachian Artisan Center in Hindman, and the Hub Weber Architects in Covington. And they help us, along with the committee and their community, design an insider experience of place that includes a sampling of local food traditions, arts and culture activities, performances, community history, hiking trails and swimming holes, and a lot of intimate experiences in people's homes and gathering places. And what we found is that it's really difficult to hate someone who you've sat down, eaten a meal with, shared stories with, and probably found some common ground. And coming out of those experiences, you know, almost everyone finds common ground. Lots of people, when you do it a second time, end up building some pretty deep friendships. And if you keep getting together, it's pretty natural for collaborations that benefit both of your communities to occur. So that's our foundational belief. And a lot of that magic happens just in the way that we spend time together in communities. But the currency of connection framework that's been developed by our steering committee over time also uses a lot of facilitation techniques to bring people together and help them think about ways they can work together in the future. So, you know, consultancy protocols from the business world, meet story circles from cultural training traditions, and a lot of other techniques. But it's really that sense of place that's most powerful in bringing folks together.
We've seen these surveys lately. There's one by Pew Charitable Trust, for example, that finds that a majority of Democrats and Republicans say members of the other party are close-minded and dug in. Have you had any experience in these events with getting people from different ends of the political spectrum to sit down and talk and listen to each other?
You know, Tom, there are many ways that RUX members are diverse. And one of those ways is politically, of course. But what we found is that they share common values. These folks, the folks that are drawn to the rural urban exchange process, are passionate about their communities. They're committed to sharing their talents and their times and their time to improve their communities. And many of them really love where they're from and recognize the ways that it shaped who they are. And we found that when you focus on identity, when you focus on your passion for your community, there's a lot of common ground, and the political divides just don't come up in the way that you would expect.
Have you seen people arrive in one frame of mind and leave in another?
Well, you know, that's kind of the point, Tom. We see a lot of that in different ways. You know, I'm not sure if someone would say that they arrive as a staunch Republican and leave a progressive or vice versa. You know, what I will say, though, is that people come to the program with an open mind and they tend to utilize it. Some folks' boundaries are pushed, I think, by the things they experience in different communities and the stories that they hear. Many people hear a version of the story of Kentucky that doesn't resonate with their own. And we find that to be a really generative place where people can expand their understanding of what it means to be a Kentuckian.
Is this concept of a rural-urban exchange, is that happening elsewhere in other parts of the country?
No, the rural-urban exchange method that we've put together over the past 6 years is local to Kentucky. It's something I think that we have to be proud of in this state, is that folks from around Kentucky, around regions from Paducah to Harlan to Whitesburg to Covington, Lexington, Horse Cave, all over, have created this system of bringing folks together that's really valued in other places. It's been written about in the Wall Street Journal and in the Atlantic. I've traveled out of the country to share the program model with folks, and there's some interest in several other states in replicating the process. So it's really something that we've made locally out of our own skill and grit and experience in the state, and that other folks are really attracted to.
So if I'm really bothered by this, by the divisiveness that I mentioned earlier, and I want to overcome it some way, this would be one way to experiment with that and see how far I could take it, right?
Absolutely. You know, we have an application process open right now. Applications for the 2019-2020 Rural Urban Exchange are open until April 17th. This year, we'll be headed to Muhlenberg County, Knott County, and the Northern Kentucky region. It is a two-year commitment, so you would be accepted this year, and you would go through the experience with a cohort of 75 other Kentuckians. Usually, it's about 25 counties represented, and then you'd experience a couple additional communities next year that you didn't go to this year. So we'd love to see you apply wherever you're from. We welcome you. And I would also say, Tom, that it's a rare opportunity to get to come together with folks who have different backgrounds and experiences from you, but who are similarly aligned with your values, who also really care about their communities and how to make them better. I think most folks in this country would love to do something about the isolation that they feel from their other countrymen. I think a lot of people would love to do something about the divisiveness they feel with folks on the other side of the aisle or in a different community, but they just don't know where to start. And that's really what the Rural Urban Exchange offers. It's just a place to start, a place to come together and have a conversation with someone who comes from a different perspective than you and see what happens.
Savannah Barrett is co-founder of the Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange, RUX. Thank you, Savannah. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And to learn more, go online to KYRUX, that's one word, KYRUX.org. Before we let you go,
listen up, y'all.
NPR's Scott Simon.
Maybe even us Yankees should start saying y'all. There's a new book, Speaking of Alabama, The History, Diversity, Function, and Change of Language, where a chapter by linguistics professor Catherine Davies includes a section called A Southern Improvement to the Pronoun System. Professor Davies teaches at the University of Alabama. She joins us now from the studios of Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
How y'all doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
So what can y'all do for today's pronouns?
Well, Southern English is doing a great job because in the past, starting with Old English, we used to have a single pronoun for you and then one for more than one person, you. Mm-hmm. So thou, that was just for one person when you were speaking to that person. Mm-hmm. And then we used to have two forms of the pronoun that we used when we addressed more than one person. So it was ye and you. Mm-hmm. And then over time, we ended up with just one, which was the you, which meant we have this problem. If we're talking to one person, we say you. If we're talking to more than one person, we say you. So along comes Southern English and proposes you all becomes y'all. Mm-hmm. Now, we have other forms of that like yous and you guys.
Yeah, that's what we say in Chicago. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And youans and yins in Pittsburgh. But Southern English just took you and all and combined it, and we've got y'all. And it seems very useful.
So you all can be a collective pronoun without being gender specific.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes non-Southerners will say, well, you can use y'all when you're addressing one person.
I have made that mistake, yes.
And there's some controversy about that, but I link it to Southern politeness. So, for example, if I go into a diner by myself and sit down and the waitress comes over to me and says, y'all ready to order? Mm-hmm. One interpretation of that is that she's assuming that I couldn't possibly be eating alone. And so other people are going to be coming to join me. And so she's asking me that. And so the y'all there is in relation to all the other people that are with me who have not yet appeared.
You surely must hear from language purists who think that y'all shouldn't use y'all.
Of course. And linguists are always pushing back against that. And one could predict that eventually, because y'all seems to be spreading, that it might become our new plural you.
I think ever since the invention of broadcasting, Professor Davies, we've been hearing that this medium on which you and I are conversing is going to end regionalisms. in American language, because we're all talking like announcers like this.
Right.
But that hasn't been my experience. Regionalism still survived, don't they?
Yeah. So one of the ways that you signal where you're from and your regional identification is through speaking in a certain way. So that's why we linguists would predict that regional dialects will absolutely not die out. They may become easier for people from other parts of the country to understand. They may become focused on particular things like pronouncing I like ah, like roll tide.
Hey, you're good at this.
Yeah, and y'all, well, I practice that. You have to move your tongue forward slightly to do that.
Wait, roll tide?
Tide, there you go. There you go.
Oh, mercy. Catherine Davies is a professor of linguistics at the, do we need to say this, University of Alabama. Thank you all.
Well, thank you, Scott. It was my pleasure.
Next week on Eastern Standard, Donna Daniels and Troy Price of the Brushy Fork Institute talk to us about a disturbing trend of youth homelessness in Kentucky. By the Kentucky Department of Education's most recent count, the number exceeds 25,000 kids out there with no place to call home. Reporter Mason Adams discusses his article for Southerly Magazine about how the decline of coal has decimated the coal severance tax that was supposed to help coalfield counties build a post-coal future. That, he notes, has come on top of a long trend of diverting these desperately needed tax revenues.
If you look at the state's website for this revenue source, there's actually a flowchart that they have, and there's arrows going everywhere with some money coming off the top, some coming out the middle. Hypothetically, counties get 50% of this revenue stream, but when you actually look at how it's broke down, that's not quite the case. There's arrows going all over the place on this, and that's, I think, one of the criticisms of the way Kentucky does its coal severance tax by some policy folks is it's just too complicated and doesn't return enough money to where it's supposed to be going.
Reporter Mason Adams will be with us to share the details of his reporting. Meanwhile, a campaign is underway to update and improve the story being told about Appalachian people and culture.
Appalachia is experiencing a new economic day right now. We're trying to recreate a more just and sustainable economy in the region. We're trying to build new things that we have never done before, but also build upon what we've done always, like local foods and tourism and arts and culture and heritage.
Ivy Brashear is the Appalachian Transition Coordinator at the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, and she tells us about the campaign she leads, Appalachia's New Day. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on demand on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard is also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.